Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Welcome to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Blog Talk Radio's Homeopathy World Community Network. This is your regular weekly co-host, Alan Phillips, vaccine rights attorney. Our other regular co-host, Debbie Brock, is traveling this week and not able to join us on the show today, so I'm going to wing it and take it by myself here. The past week and recent weeks have seen just a real flood of vaccine-related news on many, many different topics. And we may talk about a little bit of that today, but I'm going to do something a little different today with regard to how we've done the show in recent weeks, though. I'm going to focus a little more on some of the actual rights issues that I'm seeing more frequently in my practice as a private practice attorney, doing primarily, if not exclusively, vaccine exemption and waiver law, working with clients around the U.S. So we're going to be talking about that some today. But I would like to call your attention to at least a couple of different interesting articles in the news. Not going to talk about the articles in depth, but just to let you know some of the things that have been in the news recently about vaccines, because there's just an ever-going flow of new activity and new news and new information, but it just seems to have been at an accelerated pace in recent weeks. So when we talk about different news items on Homeopathy World Community Radio here, Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., we are often, and most often, discussing articles the links to which are posted at the Pandemic Response Project website. That's at pandemicresponseproject.com, pandemicresponseproject.com, and then links across the top on the far right, there's a news link, and there's a page there that I am updating daily or almost daily on a regular basis, and sometimes several articles a day, which has been the case frequently here recently. So, for example, there's an article end of July talking about how GlaxoSmithKline is now shipping U.S. flu vaccines with a new strain that they're recommending for 2012 and 2013. That's sort of interesting because with flu vaccines, historically, they've always had to project or perhaps more accurately guess what the dominant flu strain is going to be in the upcoming season because that often changes year to year. Sometimes they guess correctly and sometimes they don't. So it's interesting that they're shipping a flu vaccine now with a new strain that they're covering, recommended for the upcoming flu season. So they're obviously projecting or predicting a new strain. Have to read the article to get more details on that. There have been several articles recently talking about whooping cough. And some of these articles, some of the information out, of course, is the mainstream view that, oh my gosh, there are all these whooping cough or pertussis outbreaks in various parts of the country. And we're seeing a resurgence of pertussis nationally, if not in every part of the country, in several parts of the country, that we haven't really seen in quite some time, according to at least some of these articles. Now, as you would expect, many of these article writers are immediately and instantly blaming the non-vaccinated people. But other than these articles are making a very clear case, and in some cases with information coming from health authorities, not just medical or non-medical people from the alternative vaccine arena that this really is not because or not primarily because of unvaccinated people. There are questions coming out about the efficacy of pertussis, whooping cough vaccines. Are they really as effective as they've been telling us? Now, my understanding about the studies is that pertussis has shown to be as low in efficacy as maybe 70-75%. That is that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20-25-30% of people vaccinated with the pertussis vaccine do not develop the appropriate immune response. And even the C website, which uses a much more conservative figure for vaccines generally, they say that all vaccines are 85-95% effective, but we know from the studies that some vaccines, flu vaccines in particular, have much lower efficacy rates than that, as low as 60% in one recent study. And that study was criticized as having rounded up from a number in the 50s and having misled people by presenting what's called a relative risk reduction rather than, in contrast, the actual risk reduction. I'm not going to try to explain that in detail, but the actual risk reduction using the same information and data was 1.5%, and what's called the relative risk reduction was, when rounded up, 60%. And if you're a vaccine doing vaccine research and want the blessing of the pharmaceutical industry, which figure are you going to use to convey the efficacy of vaccines? But even using that 60% figure, that's pretty low. The traditional herd immunity theory tells us that 85-95% of people need to be immune to get that herd immunity effect of something more on the order of where everybody's protected, even though not literally everyone is vaccinated or immune. So, and even the CDC admits on its own website that most outbreaks start in vaccinated people. And the reason they say that this happens is because the vaccines are not 100% effective. Well, there was some information recently suggesting that the true efficacy of the pertussis vaccine might actually be in the low 60s and not the 70-90% that range that is more typically cited or quoted or claimed. And this is not an isolated instance. We have a current lawsuit, a couple of lawsuits against Merck based on allegations saying that Merck has fraudulently misrepresented the efficacy of its mumps vaccine for the past 10 years. They claim 95%. I've even seen at least one source that was claiming 97% efficacy. And at least according to the plaintiffs in that case, the allegations are that those numbers were substantially inflated and deliberately so, fraudulently so, over the true efficacy rate. So there's some real serious questions about when we have outbreaks, whether or not it has anything to do with the vaccine or the people who aren't vaccinated. And to refer back again to the CDC website tells us that non-vaccinated people will sometimes develop this very rare and unheard of condition. You might have to go look this up. It's called natural immunity. Those of you who chuckled, you got my joke there, because it's really quite silly. Natural immunity is just something we don't talk about or hear about very much anymore, at least not in the mainstream circles. But you can actually develop natural immunity, again, according to the CDC, without even necessarily developing symptoms. So vaccination status is not a reliable indicator of immune status. There are immune people, as the mainstream medicine defines that, the antibodies. That, of course, definition is questionable, but let's accept that for a moment here for the sake of the point here. There are immune people who have been vaccinated. There are immune people who have not been vaccinated. There are vaccinated people who are not immune. And, of course, there are non-vaccinated people who are not immune as well. But, again, the vaccination status does not indicate or necessarily mean that someone is or isn't immune. You can't equate the two. mainstream authorities, of course, do this all the time, particularly pediatricians. Increasingly, pediatricians around the country are saying, are refusing altogether to treat unvaccinated children. And they seem to be basing this on, well, you're putting the other people at risk. Well, what about the 20, 30, or 40% of vaccinated kids who are not immune to pertussis? They far outnumber the unvaccinated children, but we're not trying to identify them and keep them out of the practice, or in case of schools, when there's a local outbreak, they make all the unvaccinated kids stay at home. What about the vaccinated kids who aren't immune? The 10, 20, 30, or up to 40% of vaccinated kids who are not immune, depending on what specific disease and vaccine you're talking about, what about them? Shouldn't we be identifying them and making them stay home too? Actually, in that particular situation, nobody should have to stay home because, of course, it's not feasible to test all the children in the school and find out who's immune or not immune with whatever the current outbreak is. The real medically and scientifically justifiable course of action in that situation is to simply notify all the parents immediately that there is an outbreak and let the parents decide whether or not they want to leave their kid in school or take them out temporarily, or whether they want to get their child tested to see if they're immune. The school cannot know who is or isn't a risk to the other children without testing, and of course the schools are not going to foot that bill and take the time and effort during school hours to do that. It's really a burden or responsibility that has to be, by any reasonable assessment, of course, laws often don't follow that, as current laws in place evidence, but by any reasonable measure, that should be the way that occurs. Now, I'm going to stop myself here and remind folks that there's a call-in number, and I'll give you that number in just a minute. You can get it, though, on the Blog Talk Radio website. That's blogtalkradio.com. And if you put a slash and type in the words Homeopathy World Community, all run together, I believe that'll get you to the Homeopathy World Community's radio, Blog Talk Radio page, and the number will be posted there as this show now is live and playing out. But that number, for those of you who aren't able to get to it on the air, I mean on the website, or if you're maybe having trouble finding it, it's area code 347-945-6956. Let me give you that number again in case you have something to write this down with. Again, area code 347-945-6956. We do have the chat up, so it's possible for folks to sign in on the chat while this show or any of the Homeopathy World Community radio shows are live, and I'll monitor the chat the best I can while I'm talking. Would love to hear any of your questions or comments by phone or on the chat. And we have a caller here. I don't know if that's our co-host calling in long distance or someone else, but I'm going to put that caller on. Area code 925, you're live. What can we do for you?
Hey, Alan, how you doing? It's Greg.
Hey, Greg. Thank you so much. It's terrific to see you here today.
Yeah.
Greg, as you may, some of you may know, is a regular guest co-host with us on a monthly basis. I sent Greg a last-minute note there. It said, Greg, if you're free, call in and chat with us today. Greg, I am so delighted that you got the email, short notice, and were available to call in. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, thanks. Yeah, hey, do you know the opportunity to talk about due process and health freedom? Let's do it. you're right. You know, the show is called Vaccination and Your Rights in the United States. And, you know, we could just launch right into that. I'll kick us off here with a quote from the United States Supreme Court here. Okay?
Sure, go for it.
The process clause guarantees more than fair process, and the liberty it protects includes more than the absence of physical restraint. The clause also provides heightened protection against government interference with certain fundamental rights and liberty interests. In a long line of cases, we have held that, in addition to the specific freedoms protected by the Bill of Rights, the liberty specially protected by the Due Process Clause includes the right to bodily integrity. We have also assumed and strongly suggested that the Due Process Clause protects the traditional right to refuse unwanted life-saving medical treatment. United States Supreme Court. And then I'll even give you a stronger statement. This is from the court, and actually decided that at the same time. It's called the Washington versus Harper case. And actually, let's go even to Cruzan. This is where you have the court saying, before the turn of the century, this court observed that no right is held more sacred or is more carefully guarded by the common law than the right of every individual to the possession and control of his own person, free from all restraint or interference of others, unless by clear and unquestionable authority of law. This notion of bodily integrity has been embodied in the requirement that informed consent is generally required for medical treatment. So here we have very strong statements by the United States Supreme Court saying that you have a right to bodily integrity and you may refuse medical treatment unless there is clear and unquestionable authority of law requiring it. And one of the things that we show here on this radio program is that there is a lack of clear and unquestionable authority for vaccines. We have shown that there are a plethora of vaccine exemptions that protect your right to religious freedom, your right to health freedom, your right to a philosophical exemption, and so forth. And this notion of what is clear and unquestionable authority of law is in a it is like a battleground where you have competing interests who are trying to present their view of what is the law. And so law is not this hard science like physics where I can, you know, calculate the natural number E, for example, or phi, or, you know, law is where you have to have consensus on, you know, you get different thinkers and they come to a question. You know, we have two litigants and they present a question. The different thinkers are called judges and they have to decide this question. And the process of deciding the question is part of the law. And the conclusion that those thinkers come to is also part of the law. So the law sort of has two components, the process and the conclusion. And both are, we call this due process. And so it is under this due process that the Supreme Court, the highest court in our country, has said that you have a right to bodily integrity. That was a mouthful.
It was, and I tell you, I was typing as fast as I could here because there was just the questions in my mind and follow-up things here. You've given us enough to fill the hour, I bet, just pursuing some of the things you've already mentioned here. First thing I wanted to was go back right to the very top there, and I know there's an aspect of the phrase due process that confuses law students in law school and so surely must also from time to time confuse the general public, and I don't want to spend too much time on it because I'm talking sort of on the definition level, but just to let folks know that, and I'm going to, Greg, I'm going to communicate my understanding. By all means, please feel free to refine or correct or add to what I'm about to say here. I do not consider myself a constitutional law attorney, although, of course, I'm familiar with a lot of the constitutional rights that are connected with vaccine exemptions and waivers, but with regard to the Constitution at large, a fairly narrow a portion and specific application of the Constitution. But my recollection from law school, let's say, is that due process is a word that actually there's two kinds of due process. There's what they call substantive due process and procedural due process. And in just really quick description, procedural means exactly what it sounds like, the procedure. For example, with some rare exceptions, for example, in emergencies, you generally can't go to court and ask the court to order something in your favor unless you've given proper notice in advance to the other side so they have an opportunity to come in and tell their side of the story. There are those occasional court cases where the other side gets notice and doesn't show up, and those are great because you can win those pretty easily if you're the side that does show up. But the point is that the courts, at least theoretically, try to structure the procedures in a way that is fair to both sides or all sides, and that's in a general sense what procedural due process is about, just fairness to all concerned so that the court has the best opportunity possible to come up with a good and proper conclusion or ruling. But then, and I suspect it's the substantive due process that's a little more confusing to people when there's confusion. The substantive due process has more to do with something maybe in sort of a fundamental rights sense. And maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit for me, Greg, to help between the two of us articulate that as distinct from procedural due process.
Yes. The best place to start is with the actual text of the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So procedural due process is you have the right to a jury trial. You have the right to a judge who is impartial. Substantive due process is you have the right to make sure that that judge applies the proper law and you get a fair outcome. You know, he can't string you up by the heels and hang you. You know, that's not substantive due process. It's not a fair
outcome.
Just
because he doesn't like your looks or your skin color or happens to know the other side or whatever. So
yeah.
So that's there's a real simple way to summarize that then, whereas the procedural has to do with how you get through the system and the substance has to do with the way the system treats you.
And
in both cases, it has to be fair, theoretically.
Yeah, like the procedural due process is like the architecture of the system. It is your foundation, your support beams, and all that. Substantive due process is what fills it in. Like, substantive is all of your rights. You have the right to privacy, right to bodily integrity. You have the right to be free from unreasonable searches. Procedural is, let's say that there was an unreasonable search. How do we decide that case? You know, do you get a jury trial? What kind of judge do you get? How much notice do you receive before you have to respond to the complaint? So, you're kind of beating a dead horse here.
Well, no, but it's helpful, Greg. You're helping to clarify and add on to the comments that I made. It's really helpful. Let me run through, if I may, and if we get off on a tangent from this, that's fine. But I did, if it works, I have some other questions just about what you've said so far here. Now, you've made reference to bodily integrity. You've cited and quoted the Supreme Court, and of course, I'm sitting here listening to all this, and I'm just eating it all up, saying this is absolutely wonderful. I'm not sure in the area of vaccines. Well, let me back up a step. I make generalizations from time to time, especially when, for example, when talking to clients, when I'll say something like, there are few, if any, rights that are unbounded, and one person's right, for example, historically, the right to refuse vaccines for religious reasons is bounded by the state's obligation to protect the citizens, and ultimately the state has the authority to say if and when the state gets to say, oops, never mind, we're taking that exemption. So it was fascinating to me because as you're talking about the Supreme Court's, these are very strong and sweeping statements and language that I'm hearing you convey today, and it's absolutely wonderful. I'm thinking as I'm listening to some of this, well, that suggests to me that even in a declared emergency, ultimately the state or the health department cannot forcibly vaccinate me. It seems like this right to bodily integrity, as you have communicated and as you have communicated the Supreme Court has said, would prevent that. And maybe that's why, at least in part, the sort of because I'm not sure there's a case out there where somebody was vaccinated against their will, forcibly vaccinated, physically held down and vaccinated against their will in an emergency, and then they later went to court to say, is that constitutional or not? If we had such a case, I would hope, and I think expect, frankly, that the court would say that was improper, that they could have quarantined them or taken other measures, but they went too far when they forcibly injected them. And I have that opinion now even more clearly based on what you just conveyed. But my question for you, and by all means, if there's anything there you want to add to, correct, or whatever, feel free. But the question I was leading to, do you have any understanding from any of the research you've done as to where that right ends with regard to protecting our children? Because in just sort of general terms, we've all heard of the, at least in the alternative community, we hear these occasional cases where the courts force parents to allow their kids to get chemotherapy in some, you know, when they have cancer or some serious chronic disease. And I hear the instances where parents have done their research and they reasonably believe that some so-called alternative or complementary approach is really going to be the more effective approach. And then I hear these heart-wrenching tales about how an informed parent who probably really has the better decision there that they want to make is somehow prohibited from doing that because the medical doctors say, oh, no, you can't do that. That's just some wacko stuff. And if you don't do our technique, our allopathic technique or treatment, we're going to get a court order and make you do it. What is your sense, not necessarily in the real world, how things play out even, but what is your sense about what the law says about our right to bodily integrity? Does that extend, or how far does it extend to our children?
Yes. Yeah, the children have full protections under the United States Constitution Due Process Clause. The only exception is under the Parens Patriae Doctrine, which specifies that if the state gains custody of a child, then the state, under this doctrine, is allowed to act as the parent for the child, in which case they can make appropriate medical decisions for the child. And what the state deems appropriate is going to be standard. You know, they're going to give the kid conventional food, conventional medicine, conventional education, conventional killing them softly, right?
Yeah, you know, there's an organization that is seeking to add an amendment to the U.S. Constitution explicitly delineating parental rights. But in the absence of that, we do still have a strong constitutional tradition. It's a 14th Amendment due process right. There is actually due process in both the 5th and 14th Amendments. And there have been some Supreme Court cases over time that, and I think probably most of this is cases throughout and during the 1900s, where parental constitutional rights, 14th Amendment constitutional rights, have been affirmed and reaffirmed in different various situations. But there was a U.S. Supreme Court case in 1979 where the court specifically addressed the parental right to make healthcare decisions. And I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have the quote right in front of me, but it was something very similar to children, even in adolescence, do not have what is necessary to make medical decisions for themselves, that the parents can and must make those decisions. And it's so refreshing, in a sense, to see that and to realize that we have this parental right that's acknowledged, at least in the Supreme Court precedent, that stems from the Constitution. And then there was another case in, I think, 2000, where the court said that under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, that parents are presumed to be fit, to be capable of making proper and good decisions for their children unless there's a showing that they are unfit. And what that would mean in practical terms, I think, is that unless somebody believes a parent is unfit and hauls them into court and shows the evidence and the judge says, yes, I agree, this person's unfit, you are hereby officially ruled or adjudicated unfit. And that's the place, of course, where then someone else, whether it's another parent or relative or the state, some other person, but it's going to be an adult, will either by default or by court order will have the parental authority. But nowhere in there am I hearing that the state gets to make that decision. And yet there are those situations and circumstances where the doctor or a doctor can ultimately supersede the parental authority because the parent is, I guess you would have to infer at least that the parent's unfit because they want to do something different than what the doctor, who's the expert, thinks they should do. I think I'm rambling a little bit here, Greg, but here's where I'm going. I think I'm seeing some gray area or confusion or maybe even conflict or contradiction here between the authority of a medical doctor as the presumed medical expert and the parents' authority as a constitutional right to make these decisions for their children. You have any thoughts or comments about that?
Yeah, sure. A court is going to be reluctant to second-guess the doctor's opinion. So once you find yourself in court addressing these issues, what the court will do is it will commission an appropriate expert, and then that expert's testimony will be counterbalanced by whatever expert is presented by the defense. So, for example, let's say you have a child who finds himself in the system, okay, and the system wants to put him in foster care. And then you have an aunt who's a naturopath, and she wants to take care of the child instead. And the state says, well, look at this lady. You know, she's a naturopath. She's going to do the alternative thing. We think it's better if this child goes into foster care instead. So the state would present its expert, you know, Dr. Smith, MD, who wants to vaccinate this kid with, you know, harvested pus and mercury. And then you have, so he presents his testimony. Oh, yeah, so all these things, it's actually good to put sheep's blood into a child. Yes, this is very smart. We're going to fill this kid with formaldehyde. This is conventional wisdom. Of course, okay, well then, all right. And then the naturopath comes up and says, oh, no, we actually want to use natural treatments instead, and we're not going to vaccinate because that stuff poison. Then, in that case, the decision maker, which would be the court, would weigh the relative testimony of both sides and then make a determination under this doctrine of what is in the best interest of the child and then make an order accordingly. And the order would likely be this kid's going to foster care, unless they like the aunt. And they say, okay, well, we're going to go with the aunt. So what you do is you just try to present the most credible testimony that you can, the most credible doctor, and the standard by which that testimony is judged is, will this accomplish the best interest of the child?
And what's fascinating to me, though, is that that best interest, it's presumed without question, I think, the vast majority of the time anyway, that if it's a medical doctor versus a non-medical doctor, whatever the expertise is, the medical doctor has the higher authority or the sort of by default wins, that that's presumed to be what's correct and right or best, you know, in the child's best interest or not. And I don't think courts necessarily should be in the job of trying to decide the science, and I think generally they aren't in that business. And yet this is an area where desperately we need, in order to truly get what's best for the child, we desperately need some kind of system where the different approaches can be assessed objectively and as to one another, rather than somebody deferring on the basis of authority, which I think is probably more what happens. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what the system is trying to do is reach the correct outcome, and in doing that, they decided that doctors are in a better position to address medical question than judges are, and that if we have judges second-guessing medical opinions, we'll have a hodgepodge of results compared to if you have the medical profession, which generally relies on consensus and standards and, you know, what is the medical standard of care, you'll have a greater harmony, you know, quote-unquote harmony of decision.
Interesting word choice. But,
right.
But with regard to the functioning of the legal system, it is more harmony because you have more consistency. And just to help folks understand, the legal system, at least in theory, I say that a lot because, you know, a lot of what the legal system, at least initially and generally, strives for doesn't necessarily happen on individual instances. But the legal system, in theory, is designed to create some high degree of consistency. That's why we have legal precedent. We want to make sure that judges are not just sort of wildly ruling differently in the same or similar kinds of situations over time. And yes, of course, occasionally prior decisions get overturned, but that's the exception, much more so than the rule. And so it does make sense from a consistency point of view, from a predictability point of view, to try and establish some sort of order in our inherently chaotic world, to set a system up where there is some sort of reliability or consistency. Of course, the problem with that is that as soon as you establish that, let's say in the medical arena, and this could happen in other arenas, I'm sure, there's the potential for someone to try to take advantage of that to their economic or other benefit, and the consistency could ultimately serve to cause harm, which is exactly the opposite of what the idea of consistency would be looking to achieve. This happens not, of course, not only just within the legal system, but it happens in terms of the broader control of people's beliefs and understandings about the effectiveness of allopathic versus non-allopathic modalities and approaches to healthcare generally or specific diseases and so forth. But anyway, Greg, I think I'm getting off on a tangent here. If I need to
step back out here and
let you finish.
I'll close that thought by using a United States Supreme Court case. So we're going to go to 1990, Washington versus Harper, United States Supreme Court. There, you had a prisoner who was forcibly given antipsychotic medication. And the prisoner objected on the grounds that he didn't want medication. And it went before the court, and the court said, we are not going to decide whether you should or should not get medication. Rather, all we are going to decide is who gets to decide that question on a day-to-day basis. You're a psycho, so it's not going to be you. It's going to be your doctor. They see you every day. They do their clinical observations. They jot their notes down in the chart. They're the ones who decide. That is your procedural due process. And so what the court held is that, I'll just give you some quotes here. Due process clause has never been thought to require that the neutral and detached trier of fact be law trained or a judicial or administrative officer. Though it cannot be doubted that the decision to medicate has societal and legal implications, the Constitution does not prohibit the state from permitting medical personnel to make the decision under fair procedural mechanisms. So, again, you know, the court is saying, you know, we don't want, you know, to have a new case every time this guy's going to get a Prozac, you know. Rather, we just want all these decisions to be handled by the doctors, by the people on the ground who are making these notes in the chart. So once the system is set up, then the result follows. You know, I like to give the example of a tent. Essentially what you're doing is if you have a system, a medical system, that puts four stakes in the ground and says to everybody, okay, build your tent. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what person comes along. The tent's going to look the same because the stakes are already put in the ground. Unless you're willing to uproot those stakes and build a new system or just walk away from the project entirely, you are going to be under that tent. That is how the world works. And that is what the Supreme Court is basically saying here.
Yeah, and it just sounds to me like from the perspective of the legal system, that makes sense because it fosters the general legal principle of consistency and predictability that we strive for, again, to create some sort of organization in our inherently chaotic world. But at the same time, the extent to which there is that predictability in that kind of situation, there's the opportunity for somebody to say, hey, if we are the ones who get to decide, in this case the medical doctors, we can use that to our advantage. And it may not even be about the doctors. It may be that the pharmaceutical industry is saying, hey, if we can train the doctors and if we can supply them with only our way of treating whatever there is out there to be treated, then, if we can help the doctors get authority and we control the doctors, then, man, we're going to, you know, maximize our profits here because people will not be able to say, well, in this situation, I really prefer that my chiropractor or my naturopath or my acupuncturist make the decision about what treatment and whether or not to treat and so forth. So it's disturbing to me from the perspective of a citizen who feels that all modalities, and I include allopathic care, I want all of them on the table. Now, as I've looked further and further into vaccines specifically and healthcare generally and had my own experiences with both allopathic and non-allopathic treatment, more and more I get further and further away from allopathic care being my first or even anywhere near the top in my list of possible choices. But ultimately, I want it all there. I want the freedom to say yay or nay to any of them. And the practical reality, and maybe I think what I'm hearing you say, Greg, is the legal reality, if you're in a situation where it becomes a formal legal dispute at any rate, is that our choices can be very limited in terms of the modalities. And to the extent that those familiar with alternative health and complementary health recognize that for many diseases and conditions, the so-called complementary or alternative approach can be more effective. It's disturbing to hear that the courts are going to give the authority to medical doctors, at least by implication, to the exclusion of all the other options there.
And I'm also saying, try to stay out of court. Beware the risk. I can cite cases here. I mean, I have so many cases. You know, we talk about, I like to do a lot of reading. I can cite you Superintendent of Belchertown State School versus Sakowitz of Massachusetts in 1977, where the court came to a different conclusion. There you had a 67-year-old man who was very, very retarded, suffering from leukemia, and this court said that this man, he was incompetent. He had the same rights as any competent individual to refuse medical treatment. He didn't want this leukemia treatment. And they said that because the value of human dignity extends to his rights, the court adopted a substitute judgment standard where they were allowed to determine what he would have done under the circumstances. And under the circumstances, he wanted to refuse treatment, and therefore the court stepped in. So, you know, you may get lucky here, you know, to refuse treatment. You may get a compassionate court that recognizes your right to refuse treatment. On the other hand, you may not, you know, and a lot of it is how you present your case. If the court thinks that you're going to come in and bring a new suit every time somebody wants to give you a pill, they're going to say, let the doctor decide. But if the court thinks that it can decide once and for all with one final judgment, you know, one drop of the gavel, that you get to refuse in all instances treatment, they might just uphold your constitutional right to bodily integrity. And so what we find is that that convenience is part of the standard as well. And we may not find it so explicitly stated in these court opinions, but it is part of the reality of what is happening in the court system.
Well, it's fascinating, and it's sort of funny. You know, you say what you really – one of the real points you want to drive home is stay out of court. You know, I think just about anybody who has – any attorney who has been in court for some number of years, and probably the more years, the more clearly they would feel about this, that – anytime you're in court, it's a roll of the dice, and there are even situations, and I've seen this myself, where it's a clear black and white, one side's right, the other side's wrong. I've even seen those kind of situations where you get something different. The way I refer to it in more recent times is, even knowing it's a roll of the dice, I go in there with six-sided dice, and I roll, and I get a 9 and a 7. And, you know, I see things that aren't even on the dice that I'm rolling sometimes, and it just amazes me how completely open to possibility, to say it in rather neutral, objective terms, what's going to happen in court really is or really can be. And I tell you, one of my reactions to that is I no longer go to court. I'm doing I'm not going to rule out the possibility of doing that in the future, but I'm doing purely a consulting practice at this point, which makes sense because most of my clients are long distance anyway. But you don't know what you're going to get in court. And in this arena, I'm delighted to hear you report on a case where someone got to do what they wanted to do, even though there was an argument available to the other side to say that this person is not competent to make that decision. So that was a very interesting result.
And it came out of Massachusetts, which is the state where we have the famous case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And we talked about this. I think this is one of the defining cases of our generation. I mean, if you're going to read one case, people, and this is not just on the topic of vaccines, this is on the topic of law and philosophy, psychology, who we are as people, what is the social contract? You're going to read one case, 1905, Jacobson versus Massachusetts. This is a case where a preacher and his son did not want to be vaccinated for I forget what it was. Maybe it was smallpox or something.
Smallpox. And because the father had a bad reaction to smallpox vaccine when he was a child, if I understood the case correctly. But go on. So he had a really good reason. It wasn't even just some sort of – not that there aren't a list of other reasons that would be good reasons, but he had a very personal bad experience behind it.
The local health board in Cambridge, Massachusetts had passed a local law saying that anyone who doesn't get the smallpox vaccine, must pay $5. Okay,
so that was probably a lot of money, wasn't it?
Yeah, but $5 back then. Yeah, I mean, just multiply it, probably be $300 today, something like that. So the there was no, and if you didn't get it, if you didn't pay the fine, you know, there wasn't any threat of jail time or anything like that. So there was no threat that they were going to force a needle into you. So it wasn't forced vaccination; it was just a fine. That was what the question was. But in the process of deciding that case, the court goes into this diatribe as to, you know, what is permissible by the state with regard to a person. They had these lofty statements like, gosh, let me just pull some of these up. I mean, they're fascinating. Okay, here we go. This is the Jacobson court. Okay, quote, "There are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good, and he may be compelled by force, if need be, against his will and without regard to his personal wishes or his pecuniary interests, or even his religious or political convictions, to take his place in the ranks of the army of his country and risk the chance of being shot down in his defense." So the court was saying to this preacher, you know, you don't want vaccination, but, you know, we can force you to go into the army and defend the United States of America against your will. So, you know, isn't that analogous? And then, but the court also recognizes that this preacher and his son, they do have a great liberty interest that's at stake. And the court is saying, although you can be forced against your will to do certain things, this right by the state is not uncontrolled. We're not allowing absolute authority. So the court says, and I'm going to quote again here, "The liberty secured by the Constitution of the United States to every person within its jurisdiction does not import an absolute right in each person to be at all times and in all circumstances wholly freed from restraint." And then this is the one that's the one we just talked. And then it says, "Real liberty for all could not exist under the operation of a principle which recognizes the right of each individual person to use his own, whether in respect of his person or his property, regardless of the injury that may be done to others. This court has more than once recognized it as a fundamental principle that persons and property are subject to all kinds of restraints and burdens in order to secure the general comfort, health, and prosperity of the state, of the perfect right of the legislature to do which no question ever was, or upon acknowledged general principles ever can be made, so far as natural persons are concerned." Now, I invite you to read this case, because what I just said sounds like a drunk guy writing from his typewriter. That is so lofty. You know, that's like a tyrant or a king writing, okay? The Supreme Court is not without its flaws, okay? The Supreme Court has upheld slavery in the past, okay? So these men make terrible decisions from time to time. And this is an example where you have a Supreme Court judge who appears to be drinking at his typewriter and writing case opinions. He's saying things the state can infringe upon your liberties and may force you to do things against your will, just so long as it meets the general comfort, health, and prosperity of the state. And the reason that I say it's like a man drinking at his typewriter is because there are other portions of the case where he contradicts those very statements. And
let me jump in just real quick here for clarification, and then I'd love to hear a contradiction to that. And I just want to say, first of all, the hour is flying by here. We're down to about our last 10 minutes here, so just so we can both think in those terms, and I'm just amazed that the hour has flown by already so quickly, most of it. But it certainly makes sense in very general terms, for example, that people are not allowed to commit acts that we collectively call crimes because somewhere in the exercise of someone's freedom to do whatever they want is a serious imposition on others that should be curtailed or prohibited or not allowed or what have you. So the general concept that I heard you reading sounded okay to me. The question that comes up in my mind, though, is, of course, there has to be limits on what individuals can do for the safety, health, and protection of the community, but who gets to decide where the lines are and what criteria do they use to decide those lines? And the thing that disturbs me so much about Jacobson and the current state of affairs is that Jacobson, to me, reads in some ways as a setup for what has happened as a result, at least in part. I see a relationship or correlation between the two that we have today, by my estimation, after 18 or more years of ongoing research into the vaccine issue, a situation where the pharmaceutical companies have infiltrated and control the decision-making authority of the state and federal health agencies, which then impose requirements and restrictions on us, the citizens, in a way that isn't really designed to serve our best health interests, but is designed to serve the pharmaceuticals' best interest, at minimum, their financial interest. And we could talk about many other potential goals that vaccines appear to be used to be achieved to achieve as well. But the point is, there had to be some kind of a legal structure or a legal framework in place to allow that to happen for it to happen, or at least the absence of something that would, if enforced, prevent it from happening. So I don't know if I've given you two different directions to go or not here, Greg. I'm curious to know what the Jacobson says that contradicts what you just said, because Jacobson is a, I mean,
sure. Many, many
court cases are very lengthy and different lengths, and Jacobson is a fairly lengthy case, but there are a lot of things to pull out of Jacobson and talk about that are anywhere from interesting to disturbing. But please go ahead, Greg.
Sure. There are, you know, as we continue reading the Jacobson case in context, we see many avenues where individual liberty trumps forced vaccination. So, again, I just read to you some examples from Jacobson that appear to be very lofty. You know,
yes.
I give the example of a man drinking scotch at his typewriter. Now I'm going to tell you of some very measured responses, okay? Here we go. Here, the Jacobson court, this is in the, so this is the same case, same judge writing, okay? There is, of course, a sphere within which the individual may assert the supremacy of his own will and rightfully dispute the authority of any human government, especially of any free government existing under a written constitution, to interfere with the exercise of that will, close quote. Okay, so here we have a judge in one hand holding scotch saying the state can do what it wants and force you to war. In his other hand, he's holding a glass of water and saying that, but of course there is a sphere in which the individual may assert the supremacy of his own will and rightly dispute the authority of any human government to interfere with that will. Okay, so which is it? Can the government force a needle into you filled with harvested recombinant pus? Or alternatively, do you have the right to drink clean water? It's, you know, can you be peacefully natural, or can the government force you to hold a gun and shoot at a Vietnamese person? We have to, these are the questions that are being discussed by Jacobson. And one of the reasons I really dislike this opinion so much is that this shouldn't have even been before the court. This judge has taken it upon himself to decide something that was not at issue. All that was at issue was a $5 fine, and he went beyond the scope and went into what we call dicta and started talking about, you know, a forceful draft, what can be forced into a person beyond their will. And this is dicta because it didn't – all these statements that he makes have no bearing on the ultimate outcome of the case. All he has to decide on is the constitutionality of that $5 fine, just monetary issue. But he went beyond that.
We're going to have to come back and do a show on things we like to hate about Jacobson, because I have some real favorite things that I dislike about the case as well, and I'm delighted to hear your comments here. We're down to, let me see where we're at here, about 5 minutes, I think, here. Just real quick here, I don't want to change subjects, but one of my favorite things to hate about Jacobson are sections where the court says that they're not going to rule about whether vaccines are good or not, although they in effect rule that they are good, but as many Supreme Court cases or many cases over time, when they talk about vaccines, they start out with this introduction about how wonderful vaccines are and historically proven and so forth, and all of that has been disproven, and yet the courts continue to do that, including a very recent U.S. Supreme Court case about vaccines, opened up with this sort of preamble about, you know, how wonderful vaccines are, and we all know that and take it for granted. And as I'm reading that part of the opinion, I'm thinking there's nothing else in this opinion that I'm going to be able to give any real credibility to, because they've opened up with false information. But the court somewhere in Jacobson says to the effect that, you know, we're not going to judge whether vaccines are good or bad, but we acknowledge that, or we note that the majority of doctors and majority of the general population believes that vaccines are whatever appropriate in whatever way the court elaborated on that general concept. And therefore, the court is going to assume for purposes of its ruling that's the case. Now, there's something in law called judicial notice, and that's where a court decides they're going to accept something as fact without anybody having to present evidence to prove that this fact is in fact real and valid and truthful or whatever. And it's disturbing to me.
Note the legislative history, or it's also called judicial deference under the reasonable relation test.
Okay.
But the point though is that's not a republic. Our Constitution doesn't allow for that.
Well,
you have individual rights, so the court is never allowed to just take the legislature's decision and only look at that. They always have to look, at the very minimum, they have to say, well, is there a rational basis? But if the law at issue infringes on a fundamental right, then there has to be more than just a rational basis for the law. There has to be a compelling reason for the law. And the law must be written in such a narrow manner that it only targets that compelling reason, and it doesn't go too broad and affect other reasons or infringe too much on the right.
And not only was Jacobson broad, as you just described it, but Jacobson has been cited in subsequent cases and interpreted even more broadly. I saw a Fourth Circuit case from last year, I believe, where one of the attorneys tries to make the argument that Jacobson is the facts in Jacobson concern an emergency situation, and that was in fact the case. They were talking about a local outbreak in that area of Massachusetts in the initial case, and the question had to do with did the health department have the authority to require everyone to be vaccinated or not? Did you have a constitutional right to say no, and that sort of thing? And what is interesting is that subsequent courts have expanded the decision or holding in Jacobson to apply to non-emergency situations. That makes no sense legally or scientifically, and yet that's what's happened with it, as I understand. Do you have that same understanding, or any comment on that, Greg?
Yeah, I mean, the worst extension of Jacobson I've ever seen was in the 1922 case of Zucht, where they said, Zucht v. King, the quote, here it is. Jacobson versus Massachusetts had settled that it is within the police power of a state to provide for compulsory vaccination. And then the court continues, these ordinances confer not arbitrary power, but only that broad discretion required for the protection of the public health. So, you know, that was a misinterpretation of Jacobson. The court never says that you can have compulsory vaccination, but rather they just upheld that $5 rule. And they noted that Jacobson was free. Henning Jacobson, this preacher, he was free to move out of the jurisdiction if he wanted, because this was a local law.
Right.
And he could he could pay the fine if he wanted to, or he could move out of the jurisdiction, you know. Compulsory vaccination, that's sticking a needle in you. That's, you know, a fine is different than that.
Yeah.
So this idea of the
authority of the state, under the concern of infectious disease, I think I'm speculating here, but it's certainly not wild speculation. A lot of what has driven perhaps that decision and subsequent decisions interpreting or broadening Jacobson is a sort of underlying and valid up to a point, but frankly not to the extent and in the manner that it's been fully interpreted and applied, the fear of infectious disease and the concerns there. And as we were talking at the top of the show, and I know you were on hold there for a little bit, so you probably heard a lot of that, that there are, even the mainstream views, even the CDC tells us how effective and at the same time non-effective, you know, vaccines really are, and who really does pose a threat is something that people make assumptions of. But we're down to about a last minute and a half here. Greg, you want to take a few seconds to tell folks about your website or anything else you'd like them to know here? Give yourself a plug.
All right, thanks. I have a website called civilactionnetwork.org. I took the opportunity to rewrite the United States Constitution and many of the codes in America, in the goal of rebooting the nation toward justice, liberty, and sustainable living. So if you want to check that out, and you can propose your own referenda. It's a wiki-style forum, kind of like Wikipedia. So propose your own or vote on one that's already up there. And it's civilactionnetwork.org.
That sounds awesome, Greg. Thank you so much again for coming in at the last minute, and not just for coming in at the last minute, but for bringing profound insight and understanding of the law in these areas. Greg, it's just been fantastic having you. We'll get you back in here real soon at a time that you know with more advanced notice. It's always fascinating to have you here. Thank you
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-host Alan Phillips, and today with guest co-host attorney Greg Glazer, constitutional law attorney in California. Go to homeopathyworldcommunity.com and vaccinerights.com for more information about my work and the work of our regular co-host Debbie Brook with Homeopathy World Community. Thank you all so much for being here. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Share your light, let your truth be unfurled.